Okay, Shalom Aleichem, everybody. Haven't seen you in a while. Hope everybody had a wonderful Pesach. And this is my last lecture with you for the Emet Hashem of this session. I hope you've enjoyed them. You still have some more sessions after this, but not by day. And I'm open tonight to taking any questions on any of the things that I've discussed. I'm willing to try to even take questions on any of the things that any of the other speakers discuss, if you have them, so we'll try to leave a little time at the end. What I wanted to accomplish tonight is really to talk about end-of-life issues, which are probably the most common question that I encounter, the most common question that most Rabbanim are going to encounter, because we have to face it. When you're your age, you don't think about it. My age, I still don't like to think about it. But as you get older, you have to contemplate you're going to be 120 someday. And this is something Beruma Shalom. This is something that is literally Pikuach Nefashos. Every decision that you're going to make for yourself, for your patients, for a relative or a loved one, every decision that a Rav, a doctor, is going to make is literally Pikuach Nefashos when it comes to these matters. So I'd like to talk a little bit about how one goes and approaches some of the end-of-life issues, and to talk both from a legal point of view, from a secular point of view, ethical point of view, but obviously most importantly, from a medical halachic point of view, how you go about approaching these types of issues. So there are a couple of things that you need to really be familiar with. Some of them are midrashic in nature, but they really give us a tremendous idea. Abram Avinu was the first person to ask for sickness to come into the world. He asked for people to look old. I shouldn't say sickness. He asked for people to look old. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, that's a good idea. People were having trouble recognizing the difference between Abram and Yitzchak. They looked exactly the same, but one was the father, one was the son. People weren't giving proper cover to older people. So Abram said to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I think it'd be a good idea if people had gray in their beard. I think it'd be a good idea if people looked older when they're 40 than they did when they're 18. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, Yasha Kayach, it's a great idea, you first. And that's why it says, Abraham Zokein, Bar Bayamin. That's a medrash. It's a Gemara and it's a medrash. That Abraham Avinu was the first person to look old. Until then, everybody looked like they were always 20 years old, Mistama. It says that Adam HaRishon was created as a 20-year-old man. It wasn't created as a brand new baby. It wasn't created as an old man. People didn't age in the same way that we understand aging today. Abraham Avinu asked for that, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, yes, I will do that from now on, and you will be the first example of such. So Zikna starts by Abraham Avinu. When does illness and when does death preceded by illness come? So that's Yaakov Avinu. Yaakov Avinu says, until now, you know what happens when a person reaches the end of their life? They sneezed and they died. They're, so to say, neshama cannot with the sneeze. And that's why it's an almost universal custom. Anthropologists have something like this in every culture. That when people sneeze, they say something like Gesundheit. Right? The Spanish people, when they say salud, where'd they get that from? Right? When in America, they say God bless you after you sneeze. And not only Jewish people that say that, agnostics say that. Where did that come from? How did that come into our psyche? So this is also a medrash. And this is brought down by the poskim. It has halacha l'maaseh ramifications. Are you allowed to say Gesundheit in the middle of davening? Is it a hefsek? Is it not a hefsek? It's very interesting halacha l'maaseh questions. But it's all based upon this medrash that's brought down that Yaakov Avinu said, I don't think it's a good idea. He tells the Kodesh Baruch Hu that a person should be walking down the street, he sneezes, his time was up, boom. No chance to say goodbye to anybody, no chance to say vidui, no chance to make things right, correct interpersonal difficulties, give a tzavod to the children, a will, financial, ethical will. And Yaakov Avinu says, maybe it would be a good idea to get sick before you die, so people would know that the end was coming, and taka, then it would be much smoother. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Yasha Kayach, you're right. We'll begin by you. It says, Yosef is called by Menashe, he says, Hinei Avicha Choleh. your father's sick. Until then, nobody got sick. Sickness wasn't really in the world. It's an amazing idea. Now, what happens if somebody got stabbed? You know, people got into a fight. They broke an arm. So there was sickness in the world. There was trauma, obviously. In the stomach, people got other types of medical problems. You know, an ox gored you. Even before sickness, you had all the problems of an ox goring you. But sickness in the sense that we know it, people getting sick. So that was a innovation at the time of Yaakov Avinu, when he went down to Mitzrayim. It says, Hinei Avicha Choleh. And that was unusual the first time. And that really enters us into end-of-life discussion, because until then, there were really no end-of-life discussions. You sneezed and you died. Not much of an end-of-a-life shayla. You go to the rabbi, should I not sneeze? I mean, that's the pikuach nefesh shayla. You have to try to hold in your sneeze. That's not a shayla. So Yaakov Avinu, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, yes, that's a good idea. There's a lot of hashkafic reasons, I alluded to them a minute ago, why it's a good idea for a person to be sick before he dies. And the major ones that the post can bring down is it's a chance for a person to put his life in order. His financial life, to in many cases of the Gemara, shchiv meira, right? A person's on his deathbed, so he gives financial instructions. I want this child to have this, I want this child to have this, I owe so and so money, please make sure my debts are paid. You don't want to go up to Shemayim and, you know, the Sutton comes out and says, hey, this guy didn't pay back, he was loaned so-and-so, loaned him money, so-and-so he owes money to, he never paid him back. It's a chiv to pay back people that you owe money to. So the guy wants to put his life into order. So that's one of the reasons the post can bring down why Yaakov Avinu's request was granted by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. There's the concept of taking care of things that need to be taken care of. Saying the appropriate goodbyes to people. Apologizing where apologies are necessary. Accepting apologies where apologies should be accepted. So you go to your maker, you don't have a lot of kitrug either against you or against somebody else. You died without somebody apologizing to you, and you were hurt by them, and you go up to Shemayim, so that person is going to be under a lot of pressure. He never apologized to you. On the other hand, you never apologized to somebody else. You never made things straight, husband and wife, parents and children, neighbors, whatever it is. So that's another reason to put your life in order. An opportunity to say vidui. A person shouldn't waste his death. Death is a very important thing. A person shouldn't waste his death. If a person has been, he hasn't been perfect, none of us are. Death is a kapara. Death can be an atonement. If you waste it, you don't use it as a kapara, so then you, so to say, wasted your death. If a person says vidui, if a person realizes he's going to meet his maker, and he says, I'm very sorry for the things that I did, let my death be an atonement for that. So that's an unbelievably powerful tool. And that's why we do try to say vidui, where it's appropriate, how it's appropriate. That's a very complicated question. I was asked that question this past week. It comes up all the time. When do you say vidui with a patient? If the patient is of sound mind and understands what's going on, they pretty much know when to say vidui themselves. That's the rare exception. A lot of patients aren't of such sound mind. A lot of patients don't fully comprehend how far or close they are to passing away from this world. They may not be competent anymore at that point in time. They may be demented in some sort of a way. So then how do you do vidui with such a person? A person doesn't realize how sick they are. You tell them, you know, maybe it's a good idea to do vidui. You know, they're going to get a heart attack. They go, whoa, I thought I was in here for a cold. And you tell me to say vidui. Used to be a minog amongst the Chevra Kedisha. You know, it's not a good idea if the Chevra Kedisha comes and pays you a visit in the hospital. Their Chevra Kedishas also were really like a Chevra Biker Cholim. I don't know if I was in the hospital, and all of a sudden the head of the Chevra Kedisha came in with a tape measure. I'm not sure I would take that in a very positive way. But their Chevra Kedishas used to go in and visit every single patient that was sick, and they would say vidui with every single patient, and they would say, listen, most of the time we say vidui with people that have a strep throat. Most of the time we say vidui with people that are going to recover. But we do it with everybody, and this way, low plug, and people didn't get a pachad. We don't do that today. That's not the common custom. So if somebody comes into the room and says, maybe we should say vidui, that's going to be a shock to that person unless they realize where they are. So you have to be very careful. A physician who doesn't take care of end-of-life issues correctly with his patient, takes away hope, dashes all expectations of the chance of any recovery, is a rotzeach. He's damaging that person. He's hurting that person tremendously. You have to be very, very careful as a physician or as any sort of a healthcare worker giving bad news that you don't break the patient. In fact, it's usur. It's literally usur for a physician to give news to a patient that the patient can't handle. So a physician has to be very careful. In the olden days, in the 20, 30, 40 years ago, that was never a problem because doctors didn't tell you what you had. I know what you have. I'm treating you. Don't ask me any questions. It was a very paternalistic approach to patients from physicians. That swung totally the other way. That now the patients have the right to know everything. And your doctor suggests. He doesn't tell you what to do. He suggests, I think you should take this medicine. What do you think? So it's a different world. The pendulum has swung all the way in that direction. Yeah.
When you say a patient can't handle it, so how do you end up telling them?
So you have to do it in a very careful way. If the patient can't handle the news that you're going to die, you're not allowed to tell them you're going to die. Yeah, you have to tell them in a way that they can handle it. Sometimes if they can't handle it, you tell the children. American ideas and halachic ideas aren't necessarily the same in this respect.
Right.
In an American ideal...
Is that withholding information, though?
Yeah. Sometimes you have to do that.
According to what law?
According to halacha. American law doesn't say that you must tell them everything if they can't tolerate it. It's just not the hashkafa. American hashkafa is you tell them everything and hope that they can take it. I don't think American law would castigate a physician. A 95-year-old guy in the ICU says, "How am I doing, doc?" As he's gasping for breath, did you mechuyev to tell him, you're doing terrible, you're going to die within the next 6 days? I don't think even American secular ethics would say that's a good idea.
Right.
But
you tell the family.
You tell the family, right? You have to work that out. It's not a clear-cut thing also. There's a lot of art to medicine. There's a lot of art to the way you practice halacha in these situations. There are different people that may have different estimations of how a patient can tolerate something. Sometimes people surprise you. They're much stronger than they appear. Other people that are really tough, I can take anything. They're not, and they can't, and they give up hope. And that's the worst thing that you can do. Well, if you paint the picture too dark, patient's not, I don't want the therapy. You told me I'm going to suffer, it's going to be horrible, and maybe I'll get an extra month or a year to live. It's not worth it to me. So it depends how you paint the picture. So a firm physician, a person who is following halacha, has to be very, very careful with how they speak in those situations. And there are many other reasons why it's a good thing that there's some sort of an illness before death. It doesn't mean that you have to have 7 years in a coma, Rahmana Litzlan, before you die. I don't think anybody would say that that's something that's desirable. But there is a lot to be said about having end-of-life discussions from a pure hashkafic point of view as being a positive thing. But now let's get into the practical stuff. Who makes these decisions? So if you ask anybody in American secular society, there's one answer and one answer alone, the patient.
Who makes which decisions?
About what the patient will get. Do I want this treatment? Do I not want this treatment? Do you want to pull the plug? Do you want not pull the plug? So secular law, American law, can't do anything without the patient telling you they want that. Now, I'm not going to tell you that halacha allows you to countermand American law. It doesn't. But halacha works within the framework of American law, and halacha doesn't give a person total autonomy over his own body. And this is a major distinction between what we would say is secular ethics versus halacha. So I'll just give you some of the terminology that they like to use in the medical ethical world. So there are four categories. So the first one that they like to talk about is autonomy. There's a huge difference between halacha in autonomy and secular ethics, secular law in autonomy. In secular law, in American law, you can't do anything without the patient's permission. You got to get informed consent on everything. You have to get the patient's permission to treat, to not to treat, to withdraw, to do whatever it is you're going to do to the patient. If you don't get appropriate informed consent, every patient when they come into the hospital, they or their proxy, I'll talk about proxies soon, has to sign permission that you're allowed to treat them. Except in the most acute emergencies when there's no ability to do that. But otherwise, you always have to sign an informed consent, permission to be allowed to be treated. There's certain things that are presumption that we have in the United States. If somebody's hit by a car, they're in the middle of the street, the ambulance, the guy's unconscious, he didn't give us informed consent, so they just sit there and do nothing. So that's obviously ridiculous. So there's a presumption of consent when a patient is incapable of giving consent and there's nobody there that's their proxy. So that's why if somebody's sick, brought into the hospital in an accident or in a coma or whatever, you know, medical situation has overtaken them, the doctors, the hospitals do treat them. But we have rules in terms of what we can do. Before we do an invasive procedure, we need two doctors to agree and sign that he needs this procedure. Again, if they're coding in the emergency room, we don't do any paperwork. You take care of the immediate thing. But if he needs to go to surgery, so while they're preparing him for surgery, two doctors state, yeah, this guy needs surgery. There's nobody giving consent. We need to make sure that we're doing the right thing. There's not willy-nilly one guy in the middle of the night saying, yeah, he's sleeping, I'm going to open up his chest and take out his kidney. You know, so there are safeguards in place to protect the person, but the person is presumed to have total control over their body. Halacha doesn't hold like that. Halacha doesn't give a person total control over their body. HaKadosh Baruch Hu owns your body, and you're sort of like, you know, the caretaker. So you get to make decisions. Am I going to have four portions of chocolate cake, or am I going to have a salad, right? So you have certain decisions that you can make on your body. But when it comes down to something that is definitely life-saving and doesn't cause tremendous pain, suffering, or risk to you, you don't have a choice. You have to take that medicine. Now again, American law doesn't follow what the halacha says, and there's no rav that's going to force you to take a medication, because halacha says you should take the medication, but American law says that's assault and battery if I shove it down your throat. But at least in theory, halacha says you don't have a right to refuse a medication that is clearly appropriate for you and that is not painful or harmful to you to an extent that it's a significant enough risk that you have the right to refuse it. So this concept of autonomy in halacha is much more absolute, that you don't own your body, as opposed to in secular law, you own your body. So that's one idea, a big difference in end-of-life issues. By the Goyim, by secular law, the patient controls everything. If a person wants to be a Shomer Torah Mitzvah, he's going to ask his Rav, what's the halacha? Again, I'm not talking about a person that doesn't listen to halacha. If a person's in an end-of-life situation, should I put a tube down me? Should I not put a tube down me? Should I put a feeding tube in? Should I not put a feeding tube in? Should I take antibiotics? Should I take this cancer chemotherapy? Should I undergo this operation? So in American law, the patient makes all the decisions. Hopefully they're informed decisions. Hopefully the doctors have explained everything to them correctly. If a guy says, and this happens all the time, I'm 85 years old, don't much of me. I don't want this. You're going to put me on a respirator. I'm going to be alert and awake. You know, my lungs are broken, but everything else is going to be working okay. I'll live with the trach. You know, American law gives the patient the total right to refuse that if he doesn't want it. Halacha doesn't give you total right to refuse that. You have to weigh a lot of factors. So Rabbanim are very important parts of end-of-life decisions. And for Shomer Torah Mitzvot, they're involved all the time. I get calls all the time of the day and night. Rabbanim get calls all the times of the day and night. What should we do in this situation? I paskin this week on not intubating somebody, putting a tube down them. The family asked me what to do. They didn't ask the patient. They didn't say what would the patient have wanted. In American law, secular law, what would the patient have wanted? That's what everybody's supposed to ask. And we're supposed to ask, what is the halacha demand? So that's a huge difference between secular law, end of life, versus, and it's true for everything, not only end of life, but it comes up all the time with end of life versus halacha. Second principle that they like to talk about is something called beneficence. What does that mean? It's basically, you're supposed to be good. You're supposed to do, everything's supposed to be positive and beneficial for the patient. Beneficence. Beneficence. See, it teaches fancy words.
Yeah.
Oh, Beneficence. Beneficence. It's basically doing good. You know, we'd all agree to that. Not that much of a difference between halacha and secular ethics. Halacha also demands that you do good, right? A person knowingly shouldn't be doing something that's harmful to the patient. The idea over here is that who decides what's good for the patient? So, again, in secular law, society can decide what's good. Secular law can say, we're not going to give a transplant to somebody over the age of 75 years old. Halacha doesn't say that. Secular law can say, as they do in some countries, You have the right to commit suicide. If you think that you're in too much pain, you don't feel like going with your life, you have the right to commit suicide. That's beneficence. That's good for you, according to secular law. Secular society has decided that's a right that a person has, to commit suicide. If you don't think that this is true, in certain European countries, you literally are allowed to commit suicide if you have two doctors saying that you have a medical reason to, so to say, do so. Yeah, we wouldn't want to live like that either. These are alert-oriented people. In 6 states in the United States right now, including California, the most recent one, it's now been legalized for physicians to assist a patient in committing suicide. Physicians can prescribe overdoses of medications that will kill a patient. And that's legal in 6 states in the United States. Started off in Oregon, now you have California most recently. That'll never happen in New York. It's in the legislature right now. There's a bill being proposed in the New York State legislature right now that physicians in New York should be allowed to prescribe medications that will kill a patient. Intentionally, not, well, this is a side effect. No, the sole purpose of that medication that you're prescribing is for the patient to go fill that prescription, take 25 of those pills or whatever it is, and die. There's a bill in New York to now say that that's legal, should be legal. Right now it's not in New York. It's legal in California, it's legal in 5 other states.
Yeah. So in one of those states, what are the obligations that a doctor will have if the patient asks for that?
So this is the big Shaila. Let's say they pass this law. In Canada, this is a real halacha l'maaseh Shaila. Canada demands that a physician, if he can't do it themselves, refer them to somebody who will. Are you allowed to do that? Are you considered a hechsher mitzvah? Are you considered a mesayel dvar aveira? Right? So is that true or not? So I personally asked this question to Rav Asher Weiss, Shlita. This exact question. I asked him this question. And he said he didn't think there would be an issur that you'd have, that a person should have to give up his license. He'd have to give up his ability to practice medicine because they'll throw you in jail. Yeah, if you retire, they won't throw you in jail. If you do it, and they say in Canada, if you don't offer that option, you're taking care of the patient. You can't say, well, I'm punting. I'm not doing it. Let's find somebody else. No, you have to offer them. So if that were to be that you're not allowed to do that, then doctors would either be thrown in jail or they'd lose their license. So Rav Asher Weiss said he didn't think that that was an issa to go and refer them to somebody else that would be potentially capable of doing that. But a lot of physicians are very uncomfortable. I recently chaired the New York State American College of Physicians Task Force on this issue. And let me tell you that I was the lone voice saying that this is crazy, and we shouldn't be advocating physician-assisted suicide. And very compassionate and articulate physicians on the subcommittee said, I do this all the time. It's just, nobody's prosecuted me yet. These patients are in pain, they're suffering, they're very sick, end of life. Why should they have to mooch it? Why should they have to, be tortured? Now, I agree with them that there's no reason they should be in pain, there's no reason they should be suffering. We have medical capabilities to, Baruch Hashem, alleviate that in many, many, many cases. Worse comes worse, knock them out. We can alleviate pain, and put them under anesthesia, essentially, and knock them out. They won't feel pain. But to take that next step and say, well, therefore kill them, is a very halachically problematic statement. And it's absolutely forbidden. I wrote a paper for the Igud HaRabbonim. I participated in the RCA as well, the similar idea. The Aguda has come out with a similar position. This is an unusual situation that all the Rabbanim are 100% in agreement. At least all the Kashra Rabbanim are in 100% agreement that this is awesome. You're not allowed to write that prescription. You're not allowed to be a Messiaya to Ritzicha. You're certainly not allowed to do the Ritzicha. In states in Europe, in certain countries in Europe, they can actually kill them. Right. In America, the position of the AMA is no physician is allowed to participate in legal death. You know, when the court says you're sentenced to death and they have to give them a lethal injection, so it's the official policy of the AMA that no physician should do that. But if the patient wants it, then it's okay. So that's a, you know, very, very problematic situation. So this is another major issue, a difference potentially becoming worse and worse or further and further apart between secular society, what's considered beneficence. There are many very good, compassionate physicians that think that killing a patient is good for them. That's certainly not the halachic approach.
Doesn't that completely contradict the Hippocratic oath that they take at the end of medical school?
So they say no. They say no, that's to do what's best for my patient. They say this is what's best for my patient. They're suffering,
this says. The oath says
that. The Hippocratic oath is not a real thing. It's a made-up thing. It's, you know, it was originally Avodah Zarah, pure Avodah Zarah. The original Hippocratic oath was to all these gods, you know, pure Avodah Zarah. So they cleaned it up so it's not pure Avodah Zarah. Some schools say it, some schools don't. You know, it has no legal validity, no anything. It has no real validity to it. But
that was like a real oath in court.
No. No. I affirm to the Hippocratic oath. I don't think it's... It has no validity to it whatsoever, but the ideas behind it are very important. I don't mean to minimize it. The ideas behind it are very important. And these doctors, I know them. They're very good doctors. They're very nice people. They're very, very, very misguided. And none of them are Shomer Torah mitzvos. Some are Jewish, some are not. They're not Shomer Torah mitzvos. They're nice people. I don't want you to think that these are, you know, killers and horrible people. They're actually very good, compassionate doctors. But you can be a very, very good and compassionate doctor and be a rotzeach. The only way you can be a really good, compassionate doctor is if you follow what Shulchan Aruch says, if you follow what HaKadosh Baruch Hu says. You asked before, so let's go then, we'll go back to you.
Why are you assuming they're misguided if they're not in the realms of Allah?
Because it's also for a guy to be a rotzeach also. It's one of the Zion Mitzvahs when they know.
Perspective is not...
Yeah, we don't have perspectives. We have one perspective.
What's guiding...
With one perspective.
Right, but what's guiding him the right way? There is nothing...
Nothing's guiding him. That's why they're Tinoch Shenishba by whatever the rules of are by Sheva Mitzvahs B'nei Noach. I'm not sure there are rules. It says they're B'shogeg, D'chayiv Misa also. So I'm not sure that... You know, I was a Tinok Shanishba, which for a Yid maybe give you a get out of jail card free. I don't know if that works by a guy. That's a totally different halachic discussion. But it says if a Shem Mitzvah B'nei Noach person does any one of the Shem Mitzvahs B'nei Noach, he goes against and he's Chayv Misa. There's one punishment. It's very easy. Chayv Misa, Chayv Misa, Chayv Misa. It's no separation. In that respect, there's a whole discussion that they could be stricter than us in certain dinim. By abortion, if a Jewish doctor does abortion, it's not Chayav Misa, by a guy, he is Chayav Misa. So it's very interesting. It's a whole separate, you know, we have a whole very, very fascinating separate sugya in halacha. But bottom line is, they're doing it from their heart. They call it mercy killings. It's a beautiful euphemism. It, in halacha, is ritzicha. So I point that out because it's a huge divide now in the secular world. I hear doctors all the time, good doctors, saying, what do you want to mutcher them for? And they use the word mutcher. Some of them are Jewish. You know, what do you want to mutcher them for? Is this death with dignity? Is this what God wants? You know, that's the language that they're saying to get you not to follow what God wants. And again, I'm not judging them. I'm not telling you that they're horrible people. They're not. They're compassionate people. We all sympathize with the idea that this patient is suffering, and nobody would want to live like that. Nobody's doubting that. Some of these patients are in extremis. They're very sick. They're very lacking the quality of life that any of us would want to ever be in. Right? So that doesn't change the halacha. You can't kill somebody because they're not happy. And that's essentially what this is. So that's this concept of beneficence. Okay? Then there's another concept called non-maleficence. It's really like the flip side of that. Okay? Don't do anything to harm a patient. Non, don't. Maleficence, do bad stuff to them. M-A-L-E-F-I-C-E-N-C-E. Beneficence, maleficence, the word ben is good, the word mal is bad. So it just changes around the idea over here. So you're not allowed to do anything to harm. In American medical law, that's known as the famous rule, primum non nociri, which is Latin, you don't have to know what it is, means first do no harm. Okay, that's what it means. So when Rav Yaakov List puts it on the test, he won't put it in the Latin. Okay?
Don't test, don't worry.
He won't put it in the Latin. Okay?
Only English and Hebrew.
But that's the most important principle. You're talking about principles, not the Hippocratic Oath. Every doctor knows this. Do no harm. Doctors should hopefully make patients better. at best, well, it didn't work, but they shouldn't make them worse. Unfortunately, that's not always true. We give medications. Sometimes they have adverse side effects, adverse reactions, adverse outcomes. Patients die every year from things that doctors and hospitals do to them. That's unfortunately a very well-known fact. But hopefully it's never intentional. Okay? So that's this principle. Here there's really not too much difference between secular and Jewish law. The only difference might be that a patient has the right, according to secular law, to take any risk that he wants. You know, a doctor can say, listen, there's only a 1% chance that this will work. Again, most doctors fall more on the halachic side than on the legal side in this. Very few doctors will say, okay, I don't know any surgeons that will do this. There's a 1% chance that I'll save you with this procedure, a 95% chance I'm going to kill you on the table, and sure, let's go for it. It'll give you 3 extra months of life. Assuming you'd find a doctor that's willing to do that, the patient has the right to say yes to that. In halach, I don't think a patient would have the right to say yes to that, because he's destroying his chai isha with very little benefit for it. And chai isha, a short time period on this world, is also not something that you're not allowed to destroy. But in the secular aspect, at least in theory, you know, that's not called harming me. That's actually what I want. I'm willing to take that chance.
So in your opinion, what percentage would a person be allowed?
So that's the question that has no answer to it. So halacha says if it's clear cut that it will benefit you, you don't have the right to refuse it. If it's clear cut that it's going to hurt you, you don't have the right to do it. And there's that huge gray area in between, which halacha basically says an individual can make the choice. And that's why,
based
on the medical facts and what that person is willing to take in terms of a risk.
Based on which
halachically, it's based upon the fact that halacha doesn't demand you to do something that's painful or harmful that could shorten your life, but it allows you to do something that's painful and harmful if it potentially can increase your life. But that's your choice. There is no absolute over there. And medicine doesn't put things into numbers as well as everybody thinks it does. I never can tell somebody there's a 10% chance that this will happen or not happen. I can say the literature shows that there's a 10% complication rate. For you, I don't know if that's going to be 20%, 30%, 5%. It's very hard to put numbers onto a real patient in front of you. You give them, well, in a study that looked at 1,000 patients, 10% of them had this reaction. You know, 10% died from this drug. 10% died from this procedure. You know, 80% lived. Well, that halacha would certainly say is a good thing to do. But if 10% of the people die, halacha can't demand you to do something that's going to kill you 10% of the time, even with an 80% chance that you'll live. Certainly allows you to do that.
Any procedure has some certain percentage.
Right. So that's, if you remember back, I talked about how you'll have to put your life at risk. So I said you have to balance everything in the balance scale. So when you're saving somebody else's life, so you can't say, well, you know, I could, you know, I throw you that life preserver, I could throw out my shoulder, and then I'll give me an injection, I'll get infected, and then I'll get and I'll die. So I'm not throwing you the life preserver. That's, while theoretically possible, that's an argument that halacha wouldn't sanction or wouldn't allow. You have to balance things. Mishnah Berurah says you balance things. So if the balance is like this, you must do it. The balance is like this, you're not allowed to do it. When the balance is anywhere like this, halacha says it's your choice.
You wouldn't say that the balance is like a 50-50, it's more like even 90-10.
So sometimes halacha says when you reach a certain level of likelihood of killing you, then it's also to do it. You have to know the circumstances.
Is there a hidden rule here, or it's...
No. The people have thrown out different numbers. I've asked this question to a number of great gedolim, and nobody's going to put a number down. Some people have put down 5%, some people have put down 10%. They're not real numbers. I think when people start getting too technical here with statistics and numbers, they don't realize how poor those statistics and numbers really are from a medical point of view, and halacha can't be based upon poor medicine. So it's easier, the two extremes. And there's a lot of gray area in the middle. And halacha sanctions the individual to make the decisions in those gray areas.
There's a treatment from Moshe that experimental medicine.
Yeah, so the next consequence of this is, can you take an experimental therapy? So Rav Moshe and many others say, yes, you have the right to take an experimental therapy if
the homework is done.
If there is enough of a likelihood that it will benefit you and not enough of a likelihood that it will kill you, so then you're allowed to take it. But if it's painful or it can shorten your life, halacha never can demand that you do something like that. Halacha doesn't demand that of a person.
What's considered enough?
So that's what I said, you can't put a number on it.
You just guess?
No, I can, when the patient comes in front of me, I can answer that question halakhically. I can't answer it in the abstract. And even then, I sometimes can't answer it clearly. And I can say, you have a choice. And it rarely is defined by real numbers. Because I'm telling you, you have to trust me, doctors don't predict anywhere near as accurately as these numbers sound like. You know, I could give a patient an antibiotic and say, you know, the studies show that 80% of the patients in your situation will respond to this antibiotic. But that doesn't mean that this patient has an 80% chance. That's not the way it works. He's not the exact same as all the patients in the study. He has this factor that's a little bit different. He has that factor that's a little bit different. So that all changes those numbers around. So even if I have a study, a good study, that says 80% of the patients will respond, that doesn't mean that for you. Now, it's in that ballpark. It's not like a 2% chance that he'll respond or 100% chance. But when you start putting numbers in, well, there's a 10% chance he'll have a side effect, a 20% chance, you're dealing with a lot of guesswork, and halacha allows the person to make the decision. Yeah? So let's say, classic example, I know, this happens all the time. A young child, I'm thinking one particular case I know, had a tumor on his kidney. If they remove that kidney, they remove the tumor, they'll cure the kid, will go, it's going to be 120 years old. The risk of the procedure is infinitesimally small in the right hands. You know, if I took it out, then the kid's going to die. But I'm not a surgeon. So, you know, while I know where the kidney is and I can take a scalpel, as long as the anesthesiologist does, I'll slice him open and find the kidney eventually, I'm going to kill him. But if you go to a good surgeon, the good surgeon will not kill him. So halacha would state in that situation that the person doesn't have a choice. Now, American law will say, if he's above the age of 18 and he doesn't want to take that kidney out, he can't take that kidney out. You can try to prove he's not mentally competent, but he is mentally competent. He says, I don't want to live without one kidney. I don't want to go under anesthesia. Whatever. Again, irrational, yeah, but that's his choice. So halacha would say you have to take it out. American law would say you can't do it without his permission.
In a case where there's generally no risks.
In a case where, the risk benefit is so wide, halacha would insist that you have it done in a halachic society. I'm not saying an American society. But if such a person is a shomer Torah mitzvah, so he asks his rabbi, the rabbi would say, yeah, go for the operation. I'm not a believer that you go ask rabbanim, should I or should I not have the procedure? You ask them what the halacha is. But again, I'm not from that school of thought where you go get the Rebbe to tell you, you know, what to do. I'm not knocking it. I'm just telling you the hashkafa that I come from is, you know, more of a Shulchan Aruch, Nigla style of approaching the world. And kol hakavod for those that come from a different approach. I'm not chas v'sholom being pejorative against them, but where I was taught by my rabbein is you ask the doctor the medical information, and you ask the Rav to posket on that, but you don't ask the Rav to be the doctor. You know, should you or should I not go to the operation? No. You know, yes, it came to me in a nevuah, doc. So that's not the hashkafa that I work under. I'm not knocking people to go to the Rebbe. I don't understand it. To me, that's kineged the way Shulchan Aruch works. I don't got to decide this question for the whole world. When I decide for myself, I go ask a shayla to the rabbanim that I ask. The Urim Avela is still for my mom, Harini Kaparas Mishkaba. So even though I knew all the answers, quote, I asked the shayla every step of the way what to do with all these very difficult end-of-life decisions. I asked the shayla. I asked my Rebbe shayla. I didn't go to a Rebbe and ask the shayla. But other people would go to the Rebbe and ask the shayla. To each his own. You have to know your hashkafa, how you approach paskening shaylas. Okay. And then the last category is what they call justice. Okay? And basically, who's entitled to get any sort of care? So the secular world basically says that everybody should be entitled to care, and that values can be decided upon by society. The society can say that if a child is below a certain weight, we're not going to put him into the neonatal ICU. 99.9% of such children will not make it, they'll die. The 0.1% that make it are severely deformed, will have huge mental medical problems. So we're not going to, you know, if you're less than 23 weeks of gestation, we're not going to put such a child. They're born alive. I remember as a medical student, Being at a delivery with an 18-week baby, the baby lived for 2, 3, 4 hours after the birth. It was such a overwhelmingly sad situation.
The baby was going to die?
The baby had to die. 18-week baby cannot survive, even to this day. In the best ICU in the world, an 18-week baby will not survive. It's just too immature. Mother gave birth to a live 18-week baby. It lived to breathe for 2, 3 hours and then died. They didn't put it in the ICU. They didn't hook it up to monitors and machines. They put it in a warm bassinet with the heat so the baby shouldn't be in any pain. I don't think they did anything else. Because there's nothing that we could do for that baby. That baby is going to die. So essentially... So that's something that medicine does have the right to say, that certain things are futile. If a person gets a heart attack in the middle of the street, he essentially stops breathing and stops beating. 5 minutes he's lying there. They manage to ultimately do CPR and put him back in. 3 weeks later in the hospital, his EEG is flatlined essentially. There's nothing going on. Family says, let's do a heart transplant on him. You know, his heart's not working so well, right? I tell you it's medically futile. You say, well, you won't know till you try. So that type of an approach doesn't work both medically, it doesn't work halachically. You need to have something that is beduka umenusa. That's the lashon of the Rambam. Double-blind prospective study showing that something works. You can't just say, well, how do you know it doesn't work? So that's not a valid halachic argument, that's not a valid medical argument. So we've tried. We know that 18-week babies don't survive. They have tried it. They have, until they figured out that it doesn't work, they tried it. So it used to be when I was in medical school, the baby's 25, 26 weeks. Now they push it down, I think, to about 23 weeks that they have a chance to survive. And the chances are much better than they were when I was in training.
Right.
So the science is improving, but hasn't gotten yet to the point where a baby below a certain weight, below a certain level of gestation, can survive. If something's 100% fatal, we don't do it. One could argue that that's halachically not allowed.
So halachically, you can refuse treatment?
So halachically, you can refuse treatment in halacha if there is pain, suffering, or risk to your life associated with it, and put it in a nutshell. But it has to be significant. You know, 18-year-old asthmatic who they have to put a tube down to breathe for him can't say, I don't want a tube put down to breathe for me. Because 99.999% of the time, that tube will come out in 2, 3 days, and then he'll live another 100 years. So you don't have the right in halacha to refuse. American law would technically say the person has the right to refuse that. Yeah.
So then as a doctor, in terms of halacha, these cases with certain criteria, but let's say that's with 18-week-old baby, would you have to do treatment?
No. Halacha would say you don't do treatment in that situation. It's what's called futile. Halacha recognizes futility. Now, futility can be defined in different ways. A 97-year-old guy that we can treat with antibiotics and will survive another 2, 3 weeks, but still has a fatal cancer, still has some fatal disease, and will die 2 months later. So secular medicine may say, well, you're butchering the guy. And Allah will say, the guy has absolutely the right to take treatment in that situation. Chayishah is absolutely halachically a reason to take medications. Oh, the medications have side effects and they could hurt the guy.
He's not hired to do it, right?
So it depends on the situation.
If it's not painful, no risk.
So if it's not painful or no risk, depends. Depends what his underlying condition is. If his underlying condition is that he's suffering and that he's uncomfortable and in a very undesirable situation, he may not have to do things that would prolong that situation. But that's a hard answer to give in the abstract. You really need to ask that question on a particular patient with particular underlying problems, whether they're fatal underlying problems, whether they're painful underlying problems.
That's all subjective in terms of the patient also?
To a certain extent. Not absolute, but to a certain extent. Halacha does allow a patient to make certain decisions. Again, the more you get closer to the extremes, the less personal autonomy you have. The more you're closer to that middle ground that we're not sure what risks and benefits are, so then the more autonomy a person has, according to halacha. Yeah.
So what's the difference between the 18-week-old baby case and pulling a plug.
So if this 18-week-old baby had been put on a respirator, you would not be allowed to pull the plug. And here's another difference between secular and halacha. Secular reasoning does not distinguish between not starting a therapy and pulling a therapy off. What that means was, for example, in secular ethics, if a person says, I don't want to put me on the respirator, fine, they have the right to do that. He's on the respirator, he says, I want you to take me off the respirator. He has the right to do that. No difference between stopping a therapy that's already existing or not starting it. Halacha makes a distinction. Halacha gives you, under certain circumstances, the right to refuse a therapy. You have the right to say, I do not want that therapy. Person has end-stage cancer, he's having trouble breathing, his lungs are shot. If I put him on a respirator, I can breathe for this guy for another 2, 3, 4 weeks. He'll live in pain and in suffering. I'm never going to cure his disease. I can just make him live for 2, 3, 4 more weeks. So he has absolutely halachic right to refuse to do that. Absolutely. If he wants to go on the respirator, he has the halachic right to do so also. I don't want to say you're not allowed to go on the respirator. If this person says, I don't mind Yisurim, more Yisurim in this world, the better. So there are great poskim, including Rav Yashiv, amongst them, to say, Kol HaKavod, you should do that. But are you mechuyev to do it? I'm not even sure Rav Yashiv would say that you're mechuyev to do that. Rav Moshe would say you're not mechuyev to do that for certain. So, you put him on the respirator, whatever the situation was. And now he says, I don't want to be on the respirator anymore. So then, Rav Moshe, Rav Yashiv, Rav Willig, Rav Shechter, all the great poskim would say, you're not allowed to take him off the respirator in that situation. To not put him on it, certainly Rav Moshe, Rav Willig, Rav Shechter, Lamaisa, Rav Asher Weiss, Lamaisa would say, you don't have to put the guy on the respirator. But once he's on it, you're not allowed to take him off it. So that's a huge difference between halacha and secular. Secular says, well, if you don't have to put it in, you can take it out. Taking it out, if you're going to pull a plug on somebody and they're going to die directly because you pulled it out, that's called ritzicha. It's a gram ritzicha. So you're not allowed to do that. Yeah.
Who's the rabbi that said you don't have to take him off if he...
Everybody says you can't take him off once he's on. I don't know a posek that says you could pull the rest of
him. I don't know. You said a rabbi.
To do what?
No, you said a rabbi's name. I just wanted to write it down.
No. To do what? Tell me what I...
You don't have to take him off the ventilator.
Everybody says you're not allowed to take him off the respirator. Do you have to put him on the respirator? So many great poskim, including the ones I personally have asked, as well as what's written, would say you're not mechuyev to put somebody on in that situation. Rav Yashiv is a very machmir opinion in the sense he's quicker, I think, to say you have to take therapies that other poskim might say you don't have to take. But even I don't think Rav Yashiv would say that you're mechuyev to intubate somebody who has end-stage lung cancer, and yes, I could keep him alive for another few days by intubating him. I don't think that Rav Yashiv would say in that situation. Certainly Rav Moshe would say you do not have to. I've asked this question many times to Rabbi Willig Shlita. He certainly would say you do not have to do that. I would dare say that the vast, 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 vast majority of contemporary Rabbanim, Gedolim, Poskim that you'd ask today would absolutely say you do not have to put that person on a respirator. But as I pointed out, it certainly would be mutter, according to Rav Yashiv, to do so. And many other poskim would say, if that's what the person wants, then he's allowed to do that. Yeah.
Why would it be mutter that the question has to Rav Yashiv?
Why wouldn't
it be mutter to put on a respirator?
Because you're prolonging death. But again, there is a Gemara that talks about that you shouldn't prolong death. You should always prolong life, but it says you're allowed. The guy is banging on the axe on the tree, and there's a person who's a ghost. He's trying to die in the house, and every time you bang, he's startled and he doesn't die. So it says, are you allowed to stop chopping the wood? The Gemara says, yeah, you're allowed to stop chopping the wood. He's going to die because you stopped chopping the wood. It says that's not called causing his death. That's called allowing his death to occur. You're preventing his death from occurring. There's a difference between prolonging death and prolonging life. That's that sugya. So one could make the argument, possibly, that putting such a guy on a respirator is just prolonging his death. But I think if it's not just for 10 minutes, 15 minutes, if it's going to let him go for another week or two, I think that they're certainly opposed to him. Say if he wants that, he's allowed to do that.
I don't see why we wouldn't think you're allowed to.
Again, if somebody is dying, if somebody is literally dying, we have nothing to offer him. I'm not mechuyev to put a tube down him to breathe for him for another 20 minutes.
Right.
And it's possible he's a go-sase in that situation and will be also to do something to him. So it's not so simple, sure, do everything to everybody. Unfortunately, there are some rabbis that paskin like that. I've heard some very strange things from some patients. My rabbi said, you got to do everything. Everybody always said, I'll do everything. It's the most common statement I hear when we have these discussions with patients, do everything. I have a patient right now in the ICU who's not Jewish. Absolutely futile for us to do anything to him. The family wants everything done. Every nebuch organ system in this person is failing. Nothing that we do will make any medical difference. I can say that with as much vadai as you can say anything in medicine. And family wants everything done because that's a mindset. They'll do everything you can. So we're keeping his numbers pretty good, and we're keeping, you know, the machines working. He's going to die. Just a question of when. Whether it's today, tomorrow, the next day. There's absolutely nothing in medicine that will keep this person alive. This is what I would call prolonging death. And I think that there's possibly an iser in doing that. Certainly no chiv to do it. I think it's a go-sase. And you're doing all sorts of muttering to this person, you should let him die. Now, that's the rare example. Why don't you go out from here and saying that I do that regularly? This is a very rare case. Most of the time, we just don't do active things to these patients when they reach a certain end of life. It has to be end of life. They have to have a fatal disease. They have to have, you know, things wrong with them. You know, they're 80 years old and they no longer can shoot in the 70s in golf. There's some people that say, I don't want to live anymore like that. You know, the spouse dies and they say, I don't want to live anymore. And they give up. So that's not a halachic approach. That's a secular approach. I want to talk about the proxy. What happens when the patient can't make the decision? Patient's out of it. Nebuch, they have disease. They're in pain. They're given sedative drugs. They're ready. They have Alzheimer's. They have dementia. They have some underlying disease. They can't make these decisions themselves. So secular law has set up a system that there's somebody that you can designate to be your healthcare proxy. And this is a very strong recommendation that I make to everybody that they should designate such a person, and I'll tell you why. But when you're doing it, you better do it in a way that your halachic considerations will be followed. So there's an absolute need, in my opinion, that everybody should designate a healthcare proxy for themselves. That person should be instructed who you want to be your posek when these situations arise. Now, when you're 20 years old and you put down the posek and he's your Rebbe who's 60 years old, that's not going to work probably. You hope it won't work. You hope your Rebbe lives to 120 and you're 80 when your Rebbe passes away at 120. Then you need to fill out a new form, right? So what I tell people is that don't necessarily say this rabbi should be the one to decide. The person who's your healthcare proxy is almost always a child or a spouse sometimes. But pick that healthcare proxy very carefully. They should know. Listen, I daven at the Young Israel of Woodmere. I want the Young Israel of Woodmere Rabbonim type to be my posek. I want a YU Rosh Yeshiva to be my posek. Family's a Lakewood family. No, they want Malkiel Kotler. They want him to be their posek. They want in B'nai Brak. They want Rav Sternbach to be their posek. Right? You got it. Where is your posek? Where you're coming from? I always say it says in Pirkei Avos, Aseilu Harav. It should be the patient's rav, not the child's rav. So if the patient has a close relationship with their local community rav for many years. Right? Sometimes the rav isn't 60 and the patient's 20. Sometimes the patient is 60 and the rav is 20, right? So that rav has been growing up with that family. He's a young rav in the community. He's there 20 years. He knows that patient for 20 years. All of a sudden, you know, the rabbi's, the son's Rosh Yeshiva, all of a sudden is making decisions. The Rosh Yeshiva doesn't know anything about the patient. Doesn't know his hashkofa, hachayim. He doesn't know what that person wanted to be done in certain situations. There's that huge gray area. So So I always say that the Rav should be somebody that the patient wants to make those decisions. So if you're the healthcare proxy, which is a legal form, you have the authority to do whatever you think is best for that patient when that patient's not capable of making those decisions themselves. It's a very important responsibility, and it should be one person. It's not a group discussion. I've seen families torn apart. I was involved in a case, Nebuch, a year ago. Nobody's talking to each other still to this day. Terrible, terrible case. One child in the family said that they're being rotschim by doing what they're doing, because the other one asked the shayla and said, you don't have to do this therapy. And there was such a sichsuch that the shiva, they sat in opposite corners of the room and they don't talk to each other. Horrible. Is that what the loved one wanted? Is that what the parent wanted, that the children shouldn't talk to each other? So I always tell people, it's very important that they should have these conversations when they're alive, alert, and oriented, and healthy. And they tell the children, listen, Yankel's going to be the healthcare proxy. Yankel knows that my rabbi is Rabbi so-and-so. If that rabbi's not available, he knows who I would want to ask. Right? You can't give a list of 37 rabbis. If he's not available, sometimes it's 2 o'clock in the morning. The rabbi's on vacation. The rabbi's not available. The rabbi passed away. You know, these things aren't always done right before the time. They're done, you know, people go for their will, so they also go for a healthcare proxy. The healthcare proxy may not take effect till 20 years later. All the people on the healthcare proxy are all dead that he designated to be his rabbanim. So, very important that the person pick somebody that will follow his hashkafa. Obviously, if the person has irreligious children, or vice versa, he's a Baal Tshuva, and everybody else is, you know, irreligious, so he shouldn't pick somebody that's not going to follow his desires. Because the healthcare proxy essentially doesn't have to do anything that he doesn't want or she doesn't want to do. So even though you could argue, well, the patient would have wanted this, if the healthcare proxy says no, so then that's the end of the discussion, unless you take him to court, which nobody really wants to do. So I tell people the most important decision that they can make, if they want to, at 120, have everything done kiseder, the way they paskin, the way their Rav paskins, is to make sure that that's laid out clearly. And I've seen families torn apart, not just one time, many times. My Rebbe says this, my Rebbe says that. You're going to have a lot of different opinions. Rav Moshe is a very, very good opinion. Rav Yash is a very good opinion. Tzitz Eliez is a very good opinion. You have great, great Gedolim who have totally different answers to the same question. That's okay. There's no problem with that. But make sure that the patient's wishes are being followed. And it especially becomes a problem sometimes when they're very religious and they have a different hashkafa than maybe the parents had. And the parents were religious too. They were also Shalma Torah Mitzvos. And different yeshivas have different poskim and different end results. And Allah has come v'kama. As I said, if you know Rabbi Sally is going up against Rabbi Moshe, you know, so then you got a problem. You know, I was literally asked this question by a very nice female lady who is a rabbi. And she asked me for my psak halacha. You tell me what you think. The family, Nebuch, the mother passed away, a religious son and a non-religious daughter. The mother wasn't religious. The mother asked to be cremated. Nebuch, she wasn't religious. Cremation's a lot cheaper than a funeral. It's a horrible, horrible reason to cremate somebody. The religious son, the Baal Tshuva son, said, you're not allowed to cremate. The daughter, who was irreligious, said, Mom wanted to be cremated. So they asked Rabbi Sally what to do. So her psak halacha was kibud av v'eim, you should do the cremation. That's what her psak halacha was. And she asked me, did she do the right thing? So I said, with all due respect, no, you did not do the right thing. That's not how we paskin. But again, this religious Baal Tshuva son said, well, you know, that sounds like a reasonable argument. He didn't really know. He was a Baal Tshuva. He wasn't steeped in years of yeshiva learning. He didn't have, you know, deep rabbinical relationships that he could draw upon, and they followed the psak, and the mother Nebuch was cremated. So if you're in that situation, you have to make sure that the person who's going to be a healthcare proxy, because they become you, they make all the decisions for you. So it's very important that they be a Shomer Torah Mitzvos, B, they should be somebody who's somewhat knowledgeable about medicine. If you have two children, one's a doctor, one's not a doctor, otherwise they're otherwise, they love you equally well, they have the same hashkafa, or they'll follow you. If they don't have the same hashkafa, no, the YU guy will follow his father, who's a Lakewood guy, if he wants to use the Lakewood postgame, and vice versa. That's not a problem. So that's perfectly fine. So if you want to make sure your wishes are done, make sure the healthcare proxy is Shomer Torah Mitzvahs, and ideally they should be somebody knowledgeable in medicine so they can understand what's going on. And then you hopefully will have your end-of-life issues dealt with properly. Because there are a lot of very complicated questions that come up. The intubation question we already talked about. Should you or should you not put a tube down the person and breathe for them? If that stays in for about 7 to 14 days, they'll end up doing a tracheostomy use most of the time. And then that person will be on a respirator. They can come off it possibly, but often they don't. And is that what the patient wants? Is that what halacha demands? Those are very, very difficult questions. They're questions that need to have the medical facts ascertained and discuss them with the rabbi. I often suggest that the rabbi speak with the doctors and not just the patient transferring the information from the doctor to the rabbi. Because I have heard the most ridiculous things from patients when they ask me a shayla. So this is what the doctor said. I said, I guarantee you that's not what the doctor said. And I said, let's call up the doctor right now. I call up the doctor. Of course that's not what the doctor said, because I know a little bit of medicine. But if I wasn't the doctor and a rabbi, and the rabbi said, well, this is what the doctor said, the rabbi is going to paskin based upon what the patient tells him. So I say eliminate the middleman wherever possible and have the rav speak with the doctor directly, with the patient's permission, with the patient there preferably, or with the healthcare proxy there or the family there. That alleviates a lot of problems. I've heard a lot of rabbanim who ask me questions, not as a shayla, they ask me the medicals. It's clear that they don't all have tremendous knowledge of medicine. There are a lot of courses. I participated in a course last year where we gave a 9-part course to rabbanim on medical halachic issues. So they got the medicine as well as the psak halacha. And it opens up their eyes because there are a lot of very complicated things. I've been involved in some other things where we're teaching rabbanim who are poskim, so they should know what the medical facts are. They know how to poskim, but they need to understand the medicine. So that's all very, very, very important in order to make sure that the right psak halach is done. So intubation is one of the major end-of-life questions that comes up. Putting in a feeding tube. It's another major, major end-of-life issue. I was asked this question today. Should you put in a feeding tube on somebody? Person can eat, but it takes forever, and nobody has the time and the patience to feed this person. So should you put in a feeding tube? So it's a very big question. You know, you can pay somebody to feed them. You know, you hire somebody to spend 2 hours and give them lunch. You know, take another bite of applesauce, or you know, the patient's unfortunately to a certain extent out of it, but is able to eat on their own. But nobody's willing to spend 2 hours. Nobody from the family has 2 hours to spend every meal to feed the patient. So the easy way out sometimes is to put in a feeding tube. That's an easy question in the sense that you know, they weren't asking, should we put in a feeding tube? They wanted to feed the person. A bigger question is, an older patient, demented, is not eating. What do you do in that situation? It's one of the most difficult shilas. It's not so clear-cut. You always put in a feeding tube. Again, you have to look at each case individually. In general, we tend not to withhold food and water from patients. That's, according to almost all the poskim, is not something you'd ever withhold. But there are certain situations where a feeding tube is medically not going to really make a difference. And that's important to make sure you understand the medical facts. The person is dying of end-stage cancer. They will not die of starvation because you didn't feed them if you don't put in a feeding tube. I'm telling you that medically. So just because they haven't eaten in a week, you're giving them fluids, that's not a halachic reason to put in a feeding tube. But many times, rabbanim misunderstand that, oh, feeding tube will save them. It won't. So you have to know the medicine. So feeding tube is in an automatic yes. Often it is something that should be put in. But again, there are many, many halachic situations where, I've asked Gedolim, I've seen the psak of Gedolim, that it's not appropriate to put in a feeding tube. Here I would say it would be also to put in a feeding tube in this situation because you're doing a procedure on somebody that's totally unnecessary. It will not impact their life in this case that I just said. Somebody with end-stage cancer.
danger of putting in a female.
Every procedure is at risk. There's anesthesia. You're doing it. I can't tell you how many patients I've taken care of who've had complications from feeding tube in my career. So it's not a simple thing to do a procedure just because we can do it and it sounds like it's a good idea. And a Rav who doesn't understand this will say, oh, not feeding? Feeding? Halacha says you got to feed. Right? You have great poskim that say that food and water is not a subject for debate. You must always give food and water. So again, that Lanias Dati is incorrect halachically because it's incorrect medically. I'm not arguing with those poskim. The way they've been explained the facts, they're right. But they haven't been explained the medical facts correctly. And sometimes a feeding tube will make absolutely zero difference in the patient's lifespan. And therefore, it becomes to me a shaila of doing an unnecessary procedure on a dying patient and involves pain and suffering and risk of shortening their life. So if it's certainly not any benefit, I would say it's usher to do that.
Not that the feeding tube is going to cure the cancer, but if the patient feels, I mean, obviously, thank God, I don't know if the patient in that case feels hungry or not, I don't know.
So I'm not talking about every case. I'm talking about a very specific case where I'm telling you they're going to die in a week or two of their end-stage cancer. And they're just not eating right now. So again, a doctor has to use his best judgment. If you're not going to be right 100% of the time, so I can't tell you they're going to die in 14 days, I can tell you a patient's not going to make it. And in that situation, putting in a feeding tube for long-term nutritional benefit is a waste of time. And there are studies to show that. But if you have an uneducated family and an uneducated Rav, so they're going to mistakenly think, Torah says you always have to feed somebody. Now, again, often that's true. I'm not telling you that that's not right, but it's not 100% right. So the answer isn't always you must put in a feeding tube. And the answer isn't always that you can't take out a feeding tube. There are poskim under certain situations that will allow you to stop tube feedings. It's different than a respirator. A respirator you can't stop because they're going to die right away. If you stop tube feeding, so the person will not eat. They're not going to die right away. So if their underlying situation is so grave that they'll die anyway, with or without the feeding, so you're not mechuyev to continue the feeding. Again, each of these shailas has to be addressed individually. It's very important. Don't take out the message from here that you must always do something. With very few exceptions, each case needs to be individualized. Next level, do you have to give therapies? Do you have to do surgery on somebody? You have a demented 95-year-old who has a gallbladder problem. Do you do surgery on that patient or not? So these are shailas that come up all the time. In many situations, you're not mechuyev to do surgery on them. Again, each case is individualized. Certainly if the patient's alert and oriented says, I want it done, end of the discussion. But what frequently happens is you have elderly patients that have no mental status that you can ask them these types of questions, and somebody else has to make a decision on this 95-year-old Nebuch Alzheimer's patient who's in a nursing home, who has what we would call very limited quality of life, and then the shaila comes up. The doctor recommends doing, not even an emergency procedure, somewhat of an elective procedure. So do you or do you not have to do that? So the more elective it is, the more I would posken that you absolutely should not do the procedure. The more urgent it is, the more it becomes a shaila that needs to be addressed and asked. Yeah.
When you say not mechuyev, do you mean not usur or?
When I use the term not mechuyev, I mean not usur.
You mean not usur.
Right. If I say it's usur, then I'll say the word usur. Not mechuyev means
because the terminology.
Family always asks me, "Do I have to do this?"
Right.
And the phraseology that I use is, "No, you're not mechuyev to do it." Which implies that you're allowed to do it if that's what you would like, if you think that's what the patient would like, if that's your hashkaf, if that's your posek's opinion. As opposed to the example I gave before, to put in a feeding tube on somebody that's going to die in a few days is malpractice. So they don't eat for 4 days. That's not what's killing them. Again, difference between fluids and food.
Why is it malpractice?
Because it's an unnecessary procedure that's not going to prolong a patient's life. If I put a feeding tube in you right now, that's malpractice.
I'm eating that.
Right. So, but it's malpractice to do it. This patient, it's not going to help them. If something doesn't help somebody, it's malpractice to do it. I'm doing a procedure on somebody that has...
malpractice?
Yeah, if you told me you have a lot of studying to do for a test and you don't have time to go to the cafeteria, and if I put in this feeding tube, you'll be able to do much better. You'll learn more. You're a tzaddik. I'll be in the base medrash attached to a feeding tube.
Isn't there a difference when I don't have an actual problem?
So this person doesn't have a problem that's correctable by that either.
No, in terms of
malpractice,
though, he's still...
Malpractice, I define. It's not a legal usage. I define that it's chavala. That's how to me, it's chavala to do a procedure on somebody. Halachically, it's chavala. A, I'm putting him at risk, a minuscule risk, but I'm putting him at risk. I've seen patients die from a feeding tube. You can die from these procedures. You can perforate something. You're putting them under anesthesia. There's risks. There are interactions. You give them an antibiotic. I'm telling you, you have to accept the medical facts that it's not a simple thing to just do it.
Is it still also according to American law also? Is that still
to do what?
Practice?
So malpractice in American law is only if somebody sues you.
I'm saying, can you get sued for that?
Yeah. I would be very happy to be the expert witness to say that was unnecessary. If you did an unnecessary procedure, it's called an unnecessary procedure.
Even if the patient wants it?
Yeah. It's called an unnecessary procedure. Patients aren't...
Secular law.
No. Secular law, you can't demand a procedure be done.
Even if you have a problem, you can't eat, let's say.
You're asking me a different question now. That's where it will work. You're asking me where it will work. That's a different story. I'm telling you it won't work. Right? There's a big, big difference between the procedure working and do we or do we not want to do it versus a procedure that doesn't work. Understand? Okay. All right. The last thing I want to talk about, we have 2-3 minutes left, is... are you allowed to daven for somebody to die? Are you allowed to daven for somebody to die? This is not an uncommon shaila also that I occasionally get. And Nebuchadnezzar, the saddest shaila you could ever ask. Kids see their father, their mother, grandparents, their Nebuchadnezzar in a condition that nobody would ever want to be in. They ask all the halachic shailas, yes, this is necessary to be done, this is necessary to be done, this is not necessary. They're following everything, kedas v'chedin. And the prognosis is the person's going to live for another 3 months. They're in pain, yeah, we're treating the pain. They're suffering, we're treating the suffering as best as we can. They're uncomfortable having a tube down their throat. They're incontinent, they don't like the fact that their dignity is being totally disrupted. They're doing everything kedas v'chedin. They're not asking that child to stop anything. Are you allowed to daven for that loved one to die? It's a shaila. It's an unbelievable shaila. You should never ever be in a situation to ask that shaila, and you shouldn't ever be in a situation where you have to deal with that shaila. It's one of the most difficult shailas you could possibly get. And you feel for the person who's asking the shaila. To be in that situation, to watch a loved one, a spouse for 60 years, a child, a parent, terrible, terrible child. It's all based upon a Gemara in Kesubis. Gemara in Kesubis says that Rebbe was suffering tremendously, was in great pain. And I'm also the Rebbe, Rebbe's maidservant, originally davened for Rebbe to get better. But then she saw that Rebbe was in tremendous pain. He had some horrible GI disease, and every time he went to the bathroom, he was yelling and screaming. That's what the Gemara says. And I must have the Rebbe decided, I'm going to daven for Rebbe to die. She saw what pain he was in. Meanwhile, in the Beis Medrash, they have a Yom Iyun, a Yom Tehillim, a Yom Tefillah for Rebbe. So you have 100 Bachrim in the Beis Medrash, all davening for Rebbe to live. And you have Abbas of the Rebbe davening for Rebbe to die. In Shemayim, they don't know what to do. They don't know what to do. Ultimately, the Gemara concludes, Amosad the Rebbe wins out, and Rebbe passes away. The Ran, Paskins, Halacha L'maisa. The Ran says, you see, from the fact that in Shemayim, Amosad the Rebbe won out against the Beis Medrash, You're allowed to daven for somebody to die. Haraya, Amosa the Rebbe did, and in Shemayim they paskin like her. That's what the Ran says. Does anybody paskin this Ran? So the Torah, the Aruch HaShulchan, the Torah to be his father, the Aruch HaShulchan paskins this Ran. The Aruch HaShulchan says you are allowed halacha lemaisa to daven for somebody to die. Okay? Now, does anybody agree with this position of the Aruch HaShulchan? So I have a number of tshuvas over here. The most prominent is the Tzitz Eliezer, but a number of other great poskim as well. They strongly is a nice word, they strongly disagree with the Aruch HaShulchan. And say, Chas v'shalom, should you ever daven for somebody to die? Yeah, and others. Chas v'shalom, should you ever daven for somebody to die? It's connected everything we stand for. It's going to lead to people not doing everything that they should. If you daven for them to die, so then don't intubate them. If you daven for them to die, don't give me antibiotics. So they very strongly disagree with the Aruch HaShulchan. They don't paskin the Aruch HaShulchan. Rav Moshe Zatzal, the great Rav Moshe, has an in-between approach, which is the personal approach that I follow. You should never really daven for somebody to die. You shouldn't follow the Aruch HaShulchan. You shouldn't daven. Hinei nemuchlu mezumim, the daven, yiratzon, shetomus, ohavi, chas v'shalom. But you're not mechuyev to daven that they should live. Shomei HaTfilah, don't put in a 3-hour Shomei HaTfilah, please let this person live. And Rav Moshe basically says, daven that HaKadosh Baruch Hu should do what's best for this person. And that's the approach I always tell people. It's just pasnish, in my opinion, to steig in your davening that this person should go and die. Just goes against the grain. Rav Moshe says that the person has no negius. See, where I really like what Rav Moshe said was that Rav Moshe says, maybe you're davening for the person to die because you're tired of visiting them every day in the hospital. Maybe you're davening for the person to die because they're draining your bank account. Maybe you're davening for that person to die because you can't do what you'd like to do during all that time you're spending in the hospital. It's staring your learning. It's staring your marriage. You missed the Little League game again. Right? So maybe you have a negius, and that's why you're davening. So Rav Moshe seems to suggest that if it's somebody else, if they call me into the hospital, I'm not Nogei Bedavar, I'm the chaplain in the hospital, and I go from room to room and see patients. Oh, Nebuch, this patient is shrechlich, he's so sick, so bad. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, take this patient. Maybe in that situation, Rav Moshe says, you can pass him like the Aruch HaShulchan. But if there's any negius, if there's any direct personal benefit that you would get from having this person pass away, so maybe don't daven for the person to die. But you don't have to daven for the person to live. Daven, HaKadosh Baruch Hu should do what's best for this person. You can always daven that they shouldn't have pain and suffering. That's always a valid tefillah. And I'll conclude with the final thought. There's something called the tefillah shav. If you look it up in Shulchan Aruch, towards the end of the second volume of Mishnah Berurah, so it brings down there, like Reish Lamed or something like that, it brings down that it's also to daven the tefillah shav. You're not allowed to daven for a miracle. For a personal miracle, it's also to daven. And the person who has end-stage metastatic cancer, they're in the ICU. Doctor says they have a week to live. Their systems are all failing. For you to daven for a refuah shleima is a tefillah shav. It's very problematic in that situation. To daven for the person, absolutely mutter. L'chatchila, 100%. What your tefillah should daven is that patient shouldn't suffer. The patient should be comfortable. The patient should have a yeshua from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Without saying what that yeshua is, like with Moshe. You're not davening to live, you're not davening to die. They should have a yeshua from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. They should be comfortable. The family should be comfortable. We should make the right decisions halachically what to do. Those are all wonderful things to daven for. But to daven that the person should walk out of the ICU and have another 20 years of life, that's a tefillah shav. You're not allowed to daven such a tefillah. It's a hard thing to say. But that's what medical ethics is all about. Medical ethics isn't what we would like, it's what the Torah demands. And it's not always a situation that you'd like to have to paskin or you'd like to have to be in. But that's, again, that's from Yaakov, from Abraham. You get old, you get sick. That's the way of life. And that's a positive thing. And we should view these things in the way that HaKadosh Baruch Hu would like us to view them, as opportunities to improve ourselves, opportunities for the sick person to put their life in order. And that's why end-of-life issues can be a very positive as well as a very difficult time for a person's life. Okay. Any last questions on this, as well as anything else that you'd like to talk about in the half a minute that we have left?
Without Mara here, I think it's because Mara is very soon, so I don't want to rush, so feel free to like ask questions for a good few minutes. So without Mara here.
Okay, so I want to thank you all. I've enjoyed very much. I hope you guys have enjoyed this. And in Mitzvah Hashem, we still have, I think, two or three more weeks.
Yeah,
so please make sure you give those speakers, the wonderful speakers, give them your attention, and the coverage you've given me has been, you should give to them as well. I wish you all Hatzlacha Rabba in everything that you do. And in Mitzvah Hashem, I hope you don't have to put some of these things into effect, but when you do, in Mitzvah Hashem, I hope you do it correctly. Okay.